Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Programme. And I suppose you're all on holidays, everybody's on holidays, and so are the schools. So we're giving you a different programme this week because a lot of the private schools are trying to get the clever children from the state schools with scholarships. We thought we'd tell you what was available for public school children in the way of scholarships. And we'll be going overseas also, not only to the UK, but to Venezuela, and yeah, some very interesting material indeed. So let's get on with it, shall we? Andy is going to tell us about the Public Education Foundation, which was set up in New South Wales by the New South Wales Teachers Federation and others, and the scholarships that are available for young people around Australia. Over to you, Andy.
Thanks, Jane. And this is some information about the Public Education Foundation. The Public Education Foundation, PEF, is a national not-for-profit organisation dedicated to providing life-changing scholarships to young people in public education, as well as their teachers and principals. The current foundation is an iteration of an earlier state-based entity created in 2007 following an Australian Tax Office ruling allowing tax-deductible philanthropic funds to support public education. As a not-for-profit entity, PEF can accept donations from individuals, trusts and businesses based on its deductible gift recipient, DGR, status. This has permitted public education to access philanthropic funds in support of students and teachers in public schools. PEF aims to support students with particular educational needs or talents, students who, without extra help, may struggle to reach their full potential. Our focus is on removing the barriers to achievement created by social and economic disadvantage and on acknowledging and rewarding excellence. To celebrate excellence in our public schools, we also recognise high-achieving students through our academic scholarships. PEF also supports teachers, principals, and other education leaders by providing them with opportunities to access the very best professional development on offer at universities around the world. Our role is to enhance the value and reputation of public education because we know education has the power to change lives and transform communities. Helping young people in public education is one of the best investments society can make. Under the founding constitution, the Public Education Foundation's purpose is to recognise that individual students draw support and encouragement from their families, their schools, and the broader community. Support students to achieve their potential at public schools, enhance the value and reputation of public school education, target support of the school community in ways which build on evidence. Provide a tax-exempt fund for community contributions to public education. Work in collaboration with government, schools, communities and business to achieve the Foundation's goals. Their website is easily found. It's simply www.publiceducationfoundation.org.au. And from their landing page, it's pretty easy to navigate to the scholarships. There are a broad range sorted by category, such as student year range, state or territory of availability, and access criteria. The scholarships are available to Australian citizens and permanent residents. Our scholarships empower students to break through the barriers of social and economic disadvantage. We help cover the additional costs of public schooling and open doors to opportunities that nurture talent, build confidence, and support long-term aspirations. Our scholarships also recognise and reward academic excellence, celebrating the potential and achievements of public school students. What does a scholarship recipient receive? Financial support, funds for education essentials such as school supplies, camps and excursions, incidental fees, laptops and devices, tutoring and more. The amount depends on the scholarship. They may be single or multi-year scholarships. Academic support. For school scholarships, PEF works with teachers and principals to ensure ongoing support and mentoring for scholarship recipients. Award ceremony. A formal acknowledgement of recipient achievement at the annual Proudly Public Award ceremony at Sydney Town Hall. Principal scholarships give the opportunity to study at the Harvard School of Education and teacher scholarships, professional development support for teachers. Now, all the student scholarship applications for 2026 are now closed with some minor exceptions, but it's never too early to start planning for 2027. There are some scholarships still available for principals and teachers with closing dates of either the 19th of January or the 25th of January this year. Back to you, Jane.
Well, thank you so much, Andy. And as we've been telling you in the last few weeks, 2026 is going to be a year in which the teachers and the parents and the dogs, of course, have to fight for public education in Victoria, because the Labor government, they feel very secure, I suppose, given all the problems with the Liberal Party, but they have felt quite free to take $2.4 billion out of public education in this state, which is shocking and disgraceful. But the teachers have already been fighting back in December, and the AEU, that is the Australian Education Union Victorian branch, have notices of regional meetings in early February on their website. So Andy is going to tell us about these meetings, and we're hoping that some of our listeners will be able to get along to them.
Thanks, Jane. And this is the Australian Education Union Victorian branch notice of meetings information. AEU regional meetings are your chance to hear the latest news about AEU campaigns and developments in public education, discuss policy, and give feedback to your union. All members are encouraged to attend their local meeting or a meeting that works for them. It is a great opportunity for you to meet fellow AEU members from your area working in public education settings. Regional meetings are run by members and supported by your AEU organiser and AEU leadership team, held at least once a term, with larger regions having two meetings each term. An opportunity for you to stay up to date about what is currently going on at the AEU and more specifically within your sector, and a safe space for you to talk about your concerns. A place to celebrate unionism with others who are also passionate about public education, and a great place to learn more about activism and campaigning and how to be more involved in your union. We can't wait to have you attend and be part of this meeting. AEU meetings are family friendly, and these meetings will be held in a hybrid capacity, offering both online and in-person option to attend. So there's the Maribyrnong Regional Meeting and Workshop on the 3rd of February, 5 to 6 p.m, and that's going to be at the Windy Hill Social Club on the corner of Napier and Brewster Streets in Essendon. There's a Broadmeadows Regional Meeting and Workshop on the 4th of Feb, 5 to 6 p.m, Roxburgh Park Primary School, 7 to 21 Almonds Avenue, that's A-L-M-A-N-D-S Avenue in Roxburgh Park. Latrobe Plenty Regional Meeting and Workshop on the 5th of Feb, 5 to 6 p.m. at the Casa d'Abruzzo Club, C-A-S-A-D-A-B-R-U-Z-Z-O Club, 55 O'Hearns Road, Epping. And there's the Geelong Regional Meeting, AGM and Workshop on the 5th of February at 5 to 6 p.m. at the Centra Hotel, 131 Yarra Street, Geelong. And yes, I do truly encourage everyone to be involved in their union as much as possible. This is how we make things better. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Andy, for that information. And although I assume you're all on holidays, we're hoping that teachers and parents perhaps will be very interested to go along to some of these regional meetings and demand action on the funding of state schools in Victoria. But now we'll have a bit of a break, shall we?
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Did you know that 3CR received its community radio licence in 1976?
Our application was successful because of our diverse and engaged community membership.
Subscribers are at the heart of our station.
Become a 3CR subscriber today.
Call 03 8377 or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
We hope that you're still listening to the Dogs Program, the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools. We're here, as we always tell you, to defend and promote public education. The Dogs are also very much supporters of the separation of religion from the state. and they're against state aid for private schools. We have been against this since the 1960s, and everything we said would happen when you gave state aid to these private schools has happened. Australian education is becoming less and less equal year by year. Now, American, until recently, has had separation of church and state, but unfortunately Trump and his Christian nationalists have eroded this very, very important principle rather badly in that country. But Americans United for Separation of Church and State have been fighting back. They've been fighting back in the courts. And on their website, they have a blog and they call it the Trump Dump. Let's hear about what they have been doing in this last year to oppose the erosion of the separation of church and state by Mr. Trump and his acolytes. Over to Andy again.
Thanks, Jean. Trump Dump: How Americans United for Separation of Church and State fought Trump's Christian nationalist agenda this year. And this is an article from December the 22nd, 2025. A note from the editor: American United's Wall of Separation blog will provide this semi-regular summary of Trump administration actions to undermine church-state separation, religious freedom, and the rights and freedoms that depend on them. We'll keep you updated on how AU is fighting these attacks and how you can help defend church-state separation, the cornerstone of our democracy. It is hard to believe that almost a year has gone by since the Trump administration began assaulting the pillars of our democracy. One crucial democratic cornerstone under attack has been the separation of church and state, an intrinsic American invention and value that Christian nationalists are now out to destroy. Not on our watch. This year, Americans United went to court to protect the Johnson Amendment, filed two lawsuits against Trump's anti-Christian bias task force, launched an investigation into President Donald Trump's Religious Liberty Commission, developed a Know Your Rights guide for federal employees about their religious freedom rights, and much more. Americans United was made for moments like these. We are prepared and ready to defend the religious freedom of all Americans. In court to stop Trump's IRS from destroying the Johnson Amendment. Last month, AU attorneys Alexandra Zaretsky and Jess Zelf were in court in Texas to defend the Johnson Amendment, the federal law that protects the integrity of our elections and tax-exempt nonprofits by ensuring they don't endorse or oppose partisan political candidates for office. The Internal Revenue Service has proposed a radical reinterpretation of the law to allow houses of worship, but not secular nonprofits, to endorse candidates. This would not only violate the separation of church and state, but it would threaten to undermine the charitable mission of churches that could be exploited by political campaigns. The IRS's reinterpretation is part of a proposed settlement agreement in the lawsuit National Religious Broadcasters versus Bessent. Since the Trump administration refused to defend the Johnson Amendment, AU immediately sought to intervene and urged the court to reject the proposal. We are waiting for the court to rule on the settlement agreement. AU suing over Trump's anti-Christian bias task force. After Trump mandated the creation of an anti-Christian bias task force in a February executive order that was filled with lies and disinformation about purported Christian persecution, Americans United immediately began monitoring how the order would be implemented. When the Department of Veterans Affairs and State became the first federal agencies to announce they were asking employees to report allegations of anti-Christian discrimination, AU filed requests for information under the Freedom of Information Act. When the agencies failed to fulfil AU's request as required by FOIA law, we sued. Those cases are still pending. Investigating Trump's Religious Liberty Commission. Back in May, Trump created the so-called Religious Liberty Commission, purportedly to safeguard and promote America's founding principle of religious freedom. To no one's surprise, the commission was filled with Christian nationalists who began to frequently hold meetings that AU President and CEO Rachel Lazer described as church services, mostly at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. During the commission's first meeting in June, Lazer and AU Vice President of Public Policy Alessandro Teranzoni attended and were part of a group of people who walked out in disgust over the Christian nationalist rhetoric. At subsequent meetings to discuss religious freedom in public schools and in the military, it was clear the Religious Liberty Commission's mission is really to spread Christian nationalism. Trump himself spoke at a September meeting and announced the America Prays initiative, which urges Americans to pray in preparation for the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence on July the 4th, 2026. AU immediately denounced the initiative, noting people who care about religious freedom do not need to be told by the government when or how to pray. AU submitted extensive written public comments before each commission meeting, explaining the real threats to religious freedom and the role church-state separation plays in guarding against these threats. And in October, we demanded public records from the Department of Justice and the General Services Administration as part of an investigation into the commission. Stay tuned for updates on our findings. AU's campaign to help federal workers. Over the summer, the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, circulated to federal agencies a memo filled with disinformation that could lead to religious coercion and even harassment of federal workers and the public. In September, AU policy experts began distributing a Know Your Rights guide they crafted to help federal workers and agencies understand their rights and responsibilities regarding religious freedom in the workplace. Additionally, AU wrote to 19 federal agencies explaining that the OPM memo provides incorrect legal advice that could invite religious freedom violations and expose your agency to risk of litigation. We encourage anyone who has experienced a religious freedom violation in the workplace to report to us at au.org. Give the gift that keeps on giving, church-state separation. Americans United was made for moments like these. We will vigorously defend religious freedom for everyone, especially against those who wish to impose their narrow religious views on us all. Sounds like a very worthy mission. Back to you, Jean.
Well, it always does the heart good, doesn't it, to hear about people fighting. And the battle's got to go on this year, 2026, in Victoria for state schools, public schools, and it's also going to go on in 2026 over in the UK. And we're going to hear about this from Dale.
Thank you, Jean. This is an article from TES magazine by Alistair Wood. Why 2026 will be a pivotal year for the school workforce. The convergence of numerous decisions on pay, funding, and workforce will mean the risk of industrial action is high this calendar year. If 2025 was a year of false starts on school workforce issues, 2026 looks set to be when these issues come to a head. For much of the past year, difficult decisions on pay, funding, and workforce reform were deferred. In 2026, those choices will no longer arrive one by one. Instead, they will converge on the same timeline, creating a period of heightened uncertainty for schools. The question for the year ahead is whether this convergence leads to collision, compromise, or, more optimistically, consensus. So, what exactly can leaders expect from 2026? Strong reactions to reforms. The year is likely to begin noisily. The long-awaited schools white paper and special education's needs and disabilities review are expected early in the year, and both are highly political. Expectations are high across the sector, but so too is the risk of disappointment. Any proposals seen as limiting entitlement, shifting responsibility, or failing to address funding pressures are likely to provoke strong reactions from parents, schools, and unions. Meanwhile, the Children's Wellbeing and Schools Bill is expected to gain royal assent in the first half of the year. While parts of this bill are broadly welcomed, proposals affecting academy freedoms, pay and conditions, and workforce structures are likely to face detailed scrutiny. And with the government lacking a majority in the upper chamber, the bill is unlikely to pass without amendment. Changes to teacher pay and conditions. By February, a potentially riled up sector's attention is likely to shift sharply to pay and conditions. The School Teachers Review Body, STRB, has been asked to make recommendations on pay for the next 3 years and to give a view on the 1,265 hours of directed time allowance, with the government response expected in March. As in previous years, unions are calling for above-inflation increases to address long-term, real-terms erosion. However, the government has indicated that pay should rise roughly in line with inflation, with schools having to part-fund some of this from existing budgets. What makes this round different is the clarity of the fiscal position. In its evidence to the pay review bodies, the Treasury has been explicit that no additional funding will be provided beyond existing settlements. Any recommendation above the Department for Education's suggested 6.5% over 3 years would therefore need to be funded from an already squeezed DfE budget. Add to that the possibility of tinkering with the 1,265-hour allowance, and the risk of escalation becomes clear. High risk of industrial action. The STRB is likely to recommend something above the 6.5% of DfE suggestion, but well short of the pay restoration unions are calling for. The DfE won't have any new money, and as union leaders have suggested in recent weeks, the risk of collision is growing. The NEU Teaching Union has already indicated that it will hold an indicative ballot of its members on pay and school funding in February, and the NASUWT Teaching Union is likely to follow a similar path. April may prove to be the decisive month as teaching unions gather for their annual conference and the mood of the membership is tested. Decisions about whether to move from indicative positions towards formal industrial action are likely to be taken at the same time as significant changes to industrial action law come into force under the Employment Rights Act. Measures such as reduced ballot thresholds and the introduction of electronic balloting lower the practical barriers to successful strike ballots. This combination means the risk of industrial action in 2026 is arguably higher than at any point since the strikes of 2023, and the potential impact is greater if the NEU and the NASUWT and potentially the leadership unions are in step here. Summer term strikes appear a realistic possibility. While these national debates play out, schools continue to deal with the day-to-day realities of staffing. Recruitment to initial teacher training has begun to improve, and a tightening graduate labour market may make teaching appear more attractive to some. However, the cumulative impact of years of missed targets will continue to be felt, particularly in secondary schools and more remote areas. Retention will continue to be a key concern for school leaders. For many teachers, the pressures that prompt exit are cumulative rather than sudden. Workload, behaviour, complaints, and accountability pressures all contribute to a sense that the job has become harder to sustain. The growing use of artificial intelligence to generate complaints seems likely to make this worse. Restructures, mergers, and cost-saving measures. The sector will continue to innovate through greater flexibility in an effort to retain staff, but the underlying pressures remain. Similar patterns are visible across both the state and independent sectors, with restructures, mergers, and cost-saving measures becoming more common. Taken together, 2026 looks set to be a year when tough policy choices have to be made. Pay, funding, changing employment rights, and workforce pressures are no longer isolated issues, but landing simultaneously. What this convergence leads to will depend on how much trust and flexibility remain. Time will tell whether the system is able to navigate this moment without further disruption. It sounds like it's all coming to a head in the UK as well as here in Victoria. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Dale. And now we're coming back from the UK. But we're not staying in Australia for long, because Jeff is going to take us over to the country that's been very much in the news in the last week, Venezuela. Over to you, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. Sometimes problems are so complex that it seems like a Gordian knot that nobody seems to be able to untie. The situation in Venezuela is one which everyone will know about by now, where the US has decapitated the government and is claiming that it's going to run Venezuela. And how this affects public education in Venezuela will maybe be an interesting, well, it's not interesting, it's a devastating series of consequences for the chaos that's emerging down there. But the complication is, it's easy to take, we could look at all the reasons that this event has occurred, and it's very complex. The history is very complex. Venezuela has a lot of oil, and there have been machinations from other countries from all over the world. We can't delve into those things as much as we'd like to. What we'd like to do is focus on the education system in Venezuela as it stands, and look at the impacts that the changes that may occur in the near future, some of the options that might work out. This is all my editorial. To establish where we were before the decapitation event, when Nicolas Maduro was removed to the United States for a trial, we're going to look at what had happened to Venezuela since the takeover of Hugo Chavez and eventually Nicolas Maduro. So this is the best article I could find was from from the New Humanitarian, which is a reputable NGO set up originally by the United Nations after the Rwandan genocides in the 90s, and it's now based not in Africa anymore. It's now based in Geneva, and this is so it's United Nations sanctioned journalism from the heart of crises. In other words, it's designed to tell people what's going on in the middle of a crisis. Anyway, this article goes back to the 22nd of July 2025, and it's by Ivan Reyes, and it's in the New Humanitarian, and the article is titled "Anatomy of a Fall: Venezuela's Collapsing Education System." And it says, "The teachers want to teach, the kids want to go to school, but the situation in institutions is critical." And it begins. Standing under the canopy of a tree to shelter from the scorching sun in Maracaibo, Venezuela's second city, a woman in her late 50s writes with a black marker pen on a cracked whiteboard. 10 children, uniformed in white, sit on plastic chairs, some attentive, others lost in the urban bustle. Such unconventional schooling has become the new normal, not just in Maracaibo, but in communities across Venezuela, as a lack of basic state support and infrastructure forces teachers to leave their dilapidated classrooms behind and improvise outdoors. Venezuela once pioneered access to education in Latin America, registering notable achievements under former President Hugo Chavez, who implemented a series of successful reforms, including a mass literacy campaign and meal programs for students. Between 1999 and the mid-2000s, enrollment reportedly rose from 85% to 95% in primary education and from 40% to 70% in secondary. In 2005, after Chavez stated that 1.5 million Venezuelans had learned to read or write in just 2 years, UNESCO, the United Nations Educational and Cultural Agency, awarded him a major international prize. But years of mismanagement under his successor, President Nicolas Maduro, has led to severe decline in the quality of education and the unprecedented levels of absenteeism. This has come amid an all-encompassing and relentless humanitarian crisis that has marked Maduro's increasingly authoritarian 12-year rule, pushing nearly 8 million Venezuelans to migrate. By 2023, 40% of Venezuelan students aged 3 to 17 went to school irregularly. Last year, a staggering 34% of children and young adults between the age of 3 and 24, that's 3 million people, did not attend any educational institution. After a period of relative stability, the wobbling economy is at risk from new storms, rising inflation, currency deprecation, and renewed US oil sanctions. Repression has also been ramped up since the 2024 presidential election, which was decried internationally as fraudulent. All this threatens not only to deepen Venezuela's humanitarian crisis, but also to accelerate the collapse of the education system. Education is the main structural problem in the country, says Fernando Pereira, a teacher and founding member of children's rights NGO SCCODAP. In addition to the impact it has on the president and on the quality of life of the population, it compromises the possibilities of future generations and the development of the country. Sorry, that should be impact it has on the present. For this special report, the new humanitarian travelled to public schools in three different areas of historical and social relevance in Venezuela: the western oil city of Maracaibo, Ciudad Guayana in the southeastern state of Bolivar, and Margarita Island up in the north. We spoke with students, parents, grandparents, teachers and principals to find out how they're coping with the dramatic decline of the education system. We heard a long laundry list of concerns, but also found slivers of hope. If Venezuela's imploding economy already had the public education system on life support, then the COVID-19 pandemic dealt it a near final blow in mid-2020. After months without schooling or a few weeks of online classes for those who had access to the internet, in-person teaching finally resumed in September 2022. Amid a slight economic recovery, Maduro's government promoted the message that Venezuela's was fixed. However, the poorest didn't benefit from any rebound, and neither did the country's battered education system. During the pandemic, sustained outward migration caused a shortage of teachers and an uptick in children dropping out of classes. Even the educators who stayed in the country lacked the money for transportation and couldn't get to school every day. Despite rampant inflation, the minimum wage in Venezuela has been frozen since 2022. This means the average monthly salary of a teacher is about $14.50, but can be as low as $4. With government grants, monthly income can reach $50, but those bonuses don't come every month, and when they do, they are still far from enough to meet household needs. Last December, the cost of the basic monthly basket reached nearly $500. To address the situation, the government has established the Mosaic Schedule, allowing teachers to resort to other economic activities to increase their income. Teachers have started selling cakes, candies or ice creams and taking care of children in their spare time. In theory, they have to teach 4 days a week instead of five. However, most public schools are only open 2 or 3 days a week because teachers don't have the means to manage more than that. In the beach town of Manzanillo on Margarita Island, Louisiana Figuera works in fishing when she's not giving lessons, a common second activity for teachers in the coastal area desperate to put something on their family's table. The money is not enough, she told the new humanitarian. We have to go scavenging for sustenance for our daily life at home. By 2024, the growing economic challenges had led to a 72% teachers attrition rate, according to a report by the human rights NGO Fundaredes. This prompted Maduro to ask more than 200,000 teachers who were out of the education system to return to teaching, offering incentives that never arrived. Teachers on the island face other challenges too, ensuring constant intimidation by school authorities and representatives of the Ministry of Education. They threaten us in different ways. They tell us if we don't go to classes one day to work elsewhere to cover our needs, they will stop paying our salary or take away some bonuses, says Joanna Quieda, who had been teaching for 19 years. We receive threats almost daily. Teachers should have a statue of them made in their workplace, considering all the problems that there are, said Fermin Rivero, who coordinates the Nueva Esparta chapter of the Teachers Interunion in Margarita. They do their job, but the authorities take it upon themselves to humiliate and mistreat them when they can't go to class one day because they don't have enough money for bus fare, for example. Teachers have been calling for more support for years. Many have taken to the streets despite the risk of repression. Between 2022 and 2023, nearly 3,200 teacher protests were registered. Their demands are always the same: decent salaries, better pensions and retirements, and an end to persecution for protesting. But nothing has changed. Last October, the education minister, Hector Rodriguez, launched a 6-month plan to address the crisis. It included the voluntary reinstatement of retired teachers, year-round enrolment to allow children returning to Venezuela to go to school, and the end of the Mosaic Schedule. However, there was no mention of additional resources for public education, nor were educators' salaries increased, and in practice, a full schedule remains unattainable. Norelis Figueroa, principal of Batalla Naval de Puerto Cabello High School in Trinidad, Guyana, has seen firsthand the golden years of Venezuelan education vanish. "Most of the teachers we have are non-specialists," she said. "We don't have enough teachers in areas such as science, math, physics and languages." Figueroa has postgraduate diplomas and speciality in natural sciences. She would like to pursue additional training but earns about $15 a month, which doesn't allow her to study. "I lived in the era when teachers earned well. I have had to adapt to the current situation," she told the New Humanitarian. "I would like things to improve so that the teachers who left can return." In Maracaibo, the capital of the state of Zulia, known as the land of the beloved sun amongst Venezuelans, it is hot all year round. The average temperature in the city of more than 3 million people ranges from between 28 and 35 degrees Celsius. The most important economic hub in the west of the country, Maracaibo was also the centre of Venezuela's oil bonanza in the 1970s. Its boom-to-bust story over the past decade has been particularly dramatic. Even gasoline is now a luxury here. Maracaibo experienced the worst of the crisis between 2018 and 2021 and has not recovered. Long queues for fuel and frequent power cuts are still commonplace, and piped water is only available for 5 days once a month. Nancy Ferrer, director of Aristobulo Iristures Public School in Ildefonso Vasquez, north of Maracaibo, said the educational facilities in the area are unsuitable for proper teaching and learning. Her school has no piped water nor drinking water. Its electrical installations were set up by parents to provide paltry power to a few computers and fans. Further north in the city, about 20 minutes from downtown, is one of the schools where classrooms have been moved outdoors. Students sit in a space on the school ground, a roof made of zinc sheets supported by precarious wooden poles and propped up by a single brick wall, divided into three classrooms. Nearly 200 children from preschool to sixth grade, 11 to 12 years old, study in shifts here. Most are Wayuu, an indigenous ethnic group, and many have been displaced from the border area with Colombia due to violence and poor living conditions. While they're in a class, cattle pass through the schoolyard, but the children don't get distracted. They concentrate on the voices of their teachers and stare at the broken blackboards hanging on the walls. In their interviews with the New Humanitarian, the teachers praised the children for their efforts but said they desperately needed more assistance from the authorities to improve the facilities. They asked to speak anonymously, fearful that their comments could make obtaining any government support even harder. "The conditions here are as you see them," one teacher said. "The children need the construction of the school, but we still give classes here every day." The situation was no better in other parts of Venezuela, the New Humanitarian visited. Bolivar, which borders Brazil and Guyana, is Venezuela's largest state. It's crossed by two major rivers, the Orinoco and the Caroni, critical for the development of Ciudad Guyana. The irony is that several days a week, the city residents have no water. The city used to be a centre for the mining industry that exploited the state's abundant minerals, gold, bauxite, iron and alumina, experiencing a decades-long economic boom until 2015. Now fuel and gas are even more scarce than piped water, and the area's schools are run down and crying out for support. Aida Gonzalez, General Secretary of the State Teachers Association, said schools in Bolivar can't even withstand light rain and listed at least 10 in Ciudad Guyana with serious infrastructure issues. The teachers want to teach, the kids want to go to school, but the situation in the institutions is critical, says Gonzalez, who is also the chair of the state's Education Commission and a local councillor. Figueroa was proud that her students have the privilege to be given lunch daily, but she described a similar situation in her school. She explained that the more than 500 students at the Batalla Naval de Puerto Cabello struggle in such a precarious environment. "What can a student learn in a classroom that is too hot?" she asked. "We have managed to reactivate laboratory spaces thanks to donations. The kids are happy with that. The situation with the bathrooms is bad. There is no drinking water. The children have to bring water from home." School meals are not a luxury that all children in Venezuela have. Figuera, the teacher on Margarita Island who fishes to complement her salary, said students in her classroom often stop paying attention quickly because they are hungry or tell her they don't feel well because they haven't eaten. Margarita is one of the three islands in the middle of the Caribbean Sea that make up the state of Nueva Esparta. Once Venezuela's main tourism hotspot, it attracted high numbers of foreigners, but tourism declined as the complex humanitarian emergency settled in and locals rapidly lost their main source of income. Despite having sunlight for 12 hours a day and strong sea breezes, the island still depends on energy generated on the mainland and suffers frequent power outages that can last for weeks. Water, fuel and domestic gas have to be shipped from the mainland, which is now pulling more and more young people away from the island. University careers in Margarita are almost exclusively linked to the tourism sector. With this downturn, the few who still manage to graduate from high school are now preferring to leave the island to pursue other careers elsewhere. Migration abroad is also an option that Margaritans have increasingly chosen in recent years. Sitting with one of her three daughters in a boat once used for fishing for tourism trips at Manzanillo Beach, 50-year-old Yesrita Maria Gonzalez said she has 7 grandchildren, 5 of whom are in her care because their mother works all day and their father doesn't provide for family. It's 5 p.m. on Saturday and there are barely 3 Venezuelan tourists on the beach. 3 of Gonzalez's children walk along the shore and approach them to offer empanadas, 2 for a dollar, they say. Since this Mr. Maduro has been in charge, everything went downhill, said Gonzalez, lowering her voice. This government ended everything. For survival, she barters with the fishermen, empanadas in change for fish. Part of what she gets is used to feed herself and her family. The rest she sells to buy the ingredients for her empanadas and to purchase whatever her grandchildren might need. In a bad week, she makes less than $50. When that happens, she doesn't send the children to school. It pains me to think that one of my grandchildren has to watch another child be able to bring something to eat at school. I'd rather have them stay home, even if we have nothing to give them, she said. Historically, children going to public schools were guaranteed breakfast, lunch and an afternoon snack, but this isn't the case anymore, according to the National Living Conditions Survey. In 2024, only 21% of the beneficiaries received meals every day, while a recent report by Hum Venezuela, a platform that monitors and provides data on humanitarian emergency, shows that 70% of children between 3 and 17 received no food at all at school last year. The schools here are useless, Gonzalez said. When they give out food, there's only beans and pasta. When it runs out, if you don't give the child something to at home, they have nowhere to feed themselves. Everywhere, parents express concern about the future of their children and conditions they face in their place of learning. Fabiano Briqueno, a 30-year-old mother of 3 in Maricaibo, said she had seen her son come home red with heat because he had no clean water to drink or refresh himself at school. Still, she determined to make sure her children get some education. It's a determination many parents shared. Teachers also insisted on working despite the adversity for the sake of children and said the reciprocal support they get from the students' families has been vital to keeping going. We are giving education to the children, which is the most important thing, as teachers and families, because the parents are always supportive, said one teacher in Maricaibo who asked to speak anonymously. The teachers do everything they can and no one helps out. One helps as much as one can, but there are other people who do not have the means to do it, said Yoselin Gutierrez, a mother of 2 at Maricaibo. School should be normal. It should have a playground, electricity and so on. Like every mother, I'm worried about finding a good future for my children. To better understand the impact of this crisis, the new humanitarian asked some of the children to draw their school. In most cases, they said they felt good at school and loved their teachers. They drew their houses, families and teachers, mostly using warm colours. They said they felt loved at school, but they were also aware of the shortcomings. The fallout for young Venezuelans has been felt for several years already. A recent report published by Andre Bello Catholic University shows that students in the Venezuelan education system have serious learning deficiencies. For instance, around 71% of students in the third year of primary school, 8 to 9, nearly 99% of those in the final year, 11 to 12, were at the lowest performance level in mathematics in 2024. For writing and reading comprehension, it was about 84% of them. Experts have highlighted that results have been dropping steadily in recent years, that students' motivation is lower, and the gap between children in the private system, 15% of students, and the vast majority who are in public schools is widening. In Ciudad Guayana, a group of teen girls said that due to their lack of teachers, they hadn't had classes in some key disciplines since the beginning of the school year, and they described the discomfort caused by the dilapidated facilities and lack of water at school. Sulze said they plan to continue attending classes to be able to study abroad once they graduate. As the crisis has deepened, educators, families and local organisations have lost hope in the possibility of government support and have come up with their own ways to keep children on track with their education or to provide them with teaching opportunities. I'm going to leave the article there because it does go on. But I do want to leave you with a quote from Professor Scott Lucas, who's of the University College in Dublin. And he said the American attack on Venezuela was kind of like a dog chasing a car. It barked and barked and barked. But once it caught the car, it didn't know what to do. And I'll leave you with that because I think that the humanitarian crisis is not going to be made better anytime soon. There seems to be no plan for actually running Venezuela unless the new regime can turn things around, whoever that regime may be. With that, I'll leave you and pass you back to the headquarters of the dogs. Cheer up.
Yes, well, we're very much travelled this afternoon, aren't we? But I think it's time we had a little bit of a break from all that travelling, and we'll come back for our good news story.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Well, we've got our good news story. We did have a good news story that we thought was a public school up there in Kempsey, a last chance school for students facing barriers to education, mainly Aboriginal children. And it was a lovely story. And it actually should be a state school because it's very, very much publicly funded. But it has actually got, it is labelled by ACARA anyway as an independent school. So we can't really tell you about that. But we did go to a school that was nearby and which we believe has had quite a bit to do with this particular school. So we're now going to have our great state school of the week up there in New South Wales.
Every week on the Dogs Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools. School of the week. School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's Great State School of the Week is Kempsey High School. And now here's a little from their website. Kempsey High School is a Year 7 to Year 12 comprehensive co-ed secondary school in Kempsey. We're proud to be part of a strong public education system and welcome students from all backgrounds and cultures. Our vision. Kempsey High School supports children to reach their potential through quality teaching and learning within a nurturing and supportive environment. We strive to prepare all students to become lifelong learners and responsible citizens ready to engage in our local community. In partnership with families and community, our goal is to create authentic and relevant learning opportunities for students that help them develop the knowledge, cultural understanding, critical thinking skills, and character necessary to successfully lead and implement positive change in our society. Student opportunities and activities. At Kempsey High School, we offer a variety of programs in the classroom and across the school to help students build new skills, make friends, and explore new interests. Our programs include school sport, athletics, and inter-school competitions, creative and performing arts groups and showcases, cultural and language activities, excursions and incursions, interest-based clubs, student leadership opportunities, activities that support high potential and gifted learners. The agriculture team is where students can develop key skills in agriculture and primary industries with real hands-on experience. They also have a chance to compete in local and state events. When it comes to creative and performing arts, our drama, music and arts programs help students be creative and express themselves. They can join in concerts, art shows and drama activities. Trips and excursions. Our students enjoy getting out of the classroom to explore, learn and try new things. These experiences help them grow, build confidence and see how their learning connects to the real world. Recently, 8 Year 10 students successfully completed the New South Wales MTA Bliss program, meaning they have successfully completed the theory and practical requirements for their boat license. Now they set to attempt their boat license MING test. We're incredibly proud of the outstanding achievements of our 2025 HSC cohort. Their dedication, perseverance, and hard work have delivered some excellent results across a range of subjects. Highlights include 45 results above 70%, 33 band 4 results, 8 band 5 results, 4 band 6 results, and special congratulations to Layla Wicks, a standout performer achieving 4 band 6 results in Ancient History, English Advanced, Legal Studies and PDHPE, along with a band 5 in Biology, an exceptional accomplishment. Congratulations to all our Year 12 graduates. We wish you every success as you take the next exciting steps in your journey beyond Kempsey High School. And one parent of a Year 12 Kempsey High student says, "What we love most about Kempsey High is the incredible opportunities our child has outside the classroom, from cultural programs and leadership roles to sports and community projects. There's always something that helps them grow in confidence and discover new passions. It's a school that really looks after the whole student." And now some facts and figures from the Akara My School website. Kempsey High School has an enrolment of 584. Their ICSEA value is well below the average of 1,000. It's at 848. So it's representative of a substantially disadvantaged Koori community. 2% of students have parents in the highest income quartile. 8% of students have parents in the second highest income quartile. 23% of students have parents in the third income quartile, so that's lower middle class, and 66% of students have parents in the lowest income quartile. 3% of students speak a language other than English at home, and 46% of students are Indigenous. Their finances, recurrent grants from the Australian government are at $3.3 million. From the New South Wales government, $12.6 million. Private fees, $57,000. And other contributions, $321,000, which is very substantial for this area. So per student, it comes around $29,428. Capital grants over 3 years are $5.9 million. The academic results are fine, and it's an example of what strong government and strong community support can do for an economically disadvantaged rural community. So congratulations, Kempsey High School. You are our Great State School of the Week.
Congratulations to Kempsey High School. But before we go, we would like to reiterate the notice of the Federation, or rather the Australian Education Union Victorian Branch, regional meetings. The 3rd of February 2026, the Maribyrnong regional meeting, which starts at 5 and goes to 6 at the Windy Hill Social Club on the corner of Napier and Brewster Street, Essendon. So those of you who are teaching out in the western suburbs will be interested in that. The 4th of February 2026, there is a Broadmeadows regional meeting and it starts at 5 and goes to 6 also. But that is at Rossborough Park Primary School, 7 to 21 Ormonds Avenue, Rossborough Park, again in the western suburbs. And as well as that, there is the La Trobe Plenty Valley Regional Meeting, a workshop, on the 5th of February 2026, again starting at 5 and 6, and it's at the Casa d'Abruzzo Club at 55 Ahern's Road, Epping. So for those of you up in the northern suburbs, you might be interested in this, as well as that, over there in Geelong, you've got a similar regional meeting on the 5th of February, 5 o'clock to 6, and it's at the Centra Hotel, 131 Yarra Street, Geelong. So you can also go to the website and be at these meetings online. So for teachers who are listening in, state school teachers, public school teachers, we hope that you would be interested to be with your union people, because this year you will need to be fighting very hard for that money which has been taken away from you. But our time is gone. If you'd like to find out more about the dogs, we have a website at www.adogs.info. And I'd like to thank our wonderful producer, Dale, and her off-sider, Andy, who help us, and without them we couldn't get the show to air every week. And also Jeff, of course, who takes us overseas and does so much research for us. But from all of us here, from Dale, Andy, Sorrel, Jeff and myself, and 3CR, of course, it's bye for now.
Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Become a 3CR subscriber today. Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377. Be a part of your community radio station.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
3CR.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.